Stanno le nejoni e nejoni e stanno le
I am my voice, my prayers, she who walks Mother Earth and sings her songs. In all that is sacred, that is said, that is told, I cry for my people, for the world, for it is the world that I carry in my heart, for it is the world that I give life. I am life. I am the flower, the sky, the eagle who flies, the earth, the sea. I manifest all things. This is me. This is me. Embracing all that embodies the woman in who I am. Sharing the most intricate part of my being. I need not validation for what I hear, feel, or see. Validation is me. I carry my rhythms and heal from the drumbeat in my soul. All this in the essence of what makes me whole. I am my voice, my prayers, she who walks Mother Earth and sings her songs. In all that is sacred, that is said, that is told, I am the spirit of a woman.
That was Radmila Cody. This is Chris, and it is the Peace and Justice Program. We are brought to you every Friday from 11:30 to 1 here on the wonderful Best of Chico radio station, KZFR. I want to acknowledge that we are located on Machubda territory and acknowledge that we are guests here, and the Machubda Maidu are the rightful claimants of this land as the past, present, and future stewards of this land. And my guest today, I have to get her bio up here, is Mel Figueroa, and she is a PhD candidate in geography at UC Berkeley, focusing on indigenous knowledge systems, agroecology, and its lessons for sustainable development in the age of converging crises. She is a researcher and planner for the Chico Traditional Ecological Stewardship Program and the Intertribal Stewardship Workforce Initiative Climate Emergency Environmental Justice Field Coordinator for PDA, a faculty-owned owner of the Cooperative New School for Urban Studies and Environmental Justice, and a lifetime political journalist, educator, and organizer involved in a wide range of movements for social and environmental justice. Welcome, Mel.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, I'm honored to have you with us today. And I, this is an important time. The countries of the world have one chance to get it right. It sounds like it's this week. Doesn't sound maybe that we're going to get it right. So it's very important that we find ways to adapt. And I was wondering if you, I would like to know from you first about a little more about you and what about you brought you into such an incredibly invested area of study and expertise?
I guess my journey began about 15 years ago, around 2004, 2005. I grew up in L.A., and I was doing a lot of activist work around L.A., and that's when I really started kind of delving into the climate crisis. Back then, it was also peak oil, although you don't really hear that nowadays because of fracking. But you know, there was this, I think, a realization that, you know, a lot of the social justice goals we were working on and the economic justice goals that, you know, I cared about wouldn't mean a thing if we didn't have a livable Earth and a livable planet. So I started actually with the Converging Storms at Action Network in Los Angeles. And we, you know, started talking about this. We were like, okay, you know, and we saw that, you know, the environmental movement and the social justice movement, they were kind of like working on separate tracks. And so we were trying to figure out, like, how can we bring this together? Because, you know, all of these crises are interconnected. We believe that they're, you know, they're interconnected to this crisis of capitalism and also colonialism, basically an exploitative system, right, that was ruining the planet and, you know, ruining people's lives. And so it was a sort of attempt to bring the social and environmental concerns together that really got me, you know, on this road that I'm in. And, you know, I was like, I can't really talk about these issues unless, you know, I get a real grounding in environmental issues. So, you know, I went to UCLA. I transferred to UCLA, and my first class there was who would later become my advisor. She worked on the Amazon, and she what I learned in that class about the about indigenous stewardship and the way that indigenous peoples worked with the landscape and how it worked, how they worked with the landscape. I think that changed everything for me, because I think that in the general society, you know, there are certain kind of tropes that we're used to hearing. And one of them is, you know, humans like that humans automatically degrade landscapes, right? It's like the, you know, the tragedy of the commons type of an issue, and it's, you know, it's true when industry gets involved, but it's not like always the case. You know, I think some of this defeatist rhetoric around like overpopulation and all of that stuff doesn't quite take into account the whole body of indigenous knowledge and stewardship that has been, you know, that has, we're literally here because of that, right? And it's been forgotten and it's been erased by colonialism. And so that's sort of set me off and on that path. And I did my field work in the Amazon, studying indigenous agroforestry. And, you know, obviously I take that knowledge with me every day.
That's wonderful. You know, many of the peoples of the global south are being not allowed in Glasgow for this COP26 mm-hmm. summit, both because of COVID, but also because it's so expensive to go. And I'm wondering if, you know, the youth voices there, you know, the strength of the youth that are there in the streets today, this information about traditional ecological knowledge has been infiltrating the minds of young people very quickly. People are very open and eager for it. Can you talk about COP26 and how you see this present moment?
Yeah, I mean, COP26 and sort of the COPs in general, the way that they have been evolving since the Paris Agreement, certainly have been, you know, again, more and more exclusionary of the global majority, really. And, you know, and especially this year is kind of like it's a forum for governments and corporations in the global north to kind of show off their greenwashing schemes, to put it bluntly. I don't think that it's our one chance to get it right. I think that, you know, there's so much going on beneath the surface. There's so much going on in the streets. There's so much resistance that, you know, I think that, I take my hope in that, you know.
Right.
It's almost like, you know, let the rich people kind of, like, talk amongst themselves. I mean, obviously, there does need to be policy changes that need to take place, but, you know, one of the things that I have learned working with Ali Metters Knight and the Michipta tribe and the Traditional Ecological Stewardship Program is that you know, we don't have to wait for the federal government. We don't have to wait for, you know, the people who are never going to get it to get it. You know, part of what we have to do is, yes, we have to kind of look to federal policy, but only insofar as it enables the solutions to come up from below, right?
Yeah.
I'm not really looking to the federal government or Joe Biden or, you know, any of those people to save us, because I know they won't. I've already accepted that, right?
Right.
And so, you know, it kind of takes a little off of your back if you already know that they're not going to help. But what can be done on that level is to open doors, is to open pathways. And, you know, that's one of the things, I mean, one of the reasons that we got this program started is because of certain openings that were already, like, included in the 2018 Farm Bill by the Native Farm Bill Coalition. That was a coalition of sovereign nations, tribes, to leverage already existing domestic law to be able to fund self-determination programs. So, again, you know, these openings, and again, with the infrastructure bill, there is a lot that got cut. There's a lot that's bad in that, but there are some things that we can, you know, that there's some programs that are going to be funded. So we have to take advantage of them to be able to build up our own communities and build up our own programs. That's the way it has to work anyway. That's the only way it was going to work in the first place, right? Communities have to be empowered, funded, and, you know, allowed, really, to provide their own solutions and the proof of concept that alternatives are actually possible.
Right.
And that's what we're trying to go for.
So before we move on, you said something about that bill, and I would love to hear what part of it you feel that really can make a difference. The bill that the, what is it, Build Back Better bill?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of, and I was working on lobbying and in terms of, trying to get fossil fuel subsidies out of the infrastructure bill, which was partly successful. So the foreign subsidies for fossil fuels were repealed and some loopholes were closed. Mm-hmm. But by and large, domestic fossil fuel subsidies are still on the table. And so, you know, that's very disappointing.
Right.
On the other hand, there are some programs like workforce development programs, actually, that are going to get a lot of funding, like the Civilian Climate Corps. I don't know how much they're getting now. I know $38 billion was on the table before, but it's probably cut in half since everything's cut in half now. The Native Civilian Climate Corps or the Tribal Climate Corps, there's a lot of funding that is going into mitigation, which is becoming a priority for FEMA. So, you know, as we've literally seen in our own community, there's not a lot that is spent on actually preventing a disaster, but it's more spent after a disaster to come in and clean up and, you know, I don't want to say help people, but, you know, help some people, I suppose. But now there's going to be a lot more that is spent on mitigation. And that, you know, and there's a lot of that funding that is going to be captured by, you know, people with false solutions and, you know, carbon capture and all these other weird schemes. But that's also to say that that money isn't also up for grabs. We just have to come up with the programs. We have to come up with the plans, and we have to come up with the workforce to make it happen. And so, you know, Allie and I have been working for the last, you know, couple of years to actually get ourselves into the position where we are able to qualify for some of these funds and draw it down. And so, you know, hopefully that's going to open another door and another pathway. We also see how a lot of other folks are, you know, trying to make the best of what we got, you know, to get some of these programs up and running. And it kind of has to. It's one of these things, like, I mean, traditional stewardship, just like, you know, a lot of other environmental justice initiatives is like it operates on a level that a lot of folks, especially, you know, folks in, you know, sort of these official positions, can't really comprehend until they see it. And that's what we're really fighting for. We're fighting for the chance to prove it. We're fighting for the chance to try. My God, you know,
right?
like we can at least try. We can at least have a chance to try, so that people can see whether or not, you know, what kind of future they want to choose.
Yeah.
So
listeners, this is Mel Figueroa. She is a faculty owner of the Cooperative New School for Urban Studies and Environmental Justice and a PhD candidate in geography, specializing in agroecology at UC Berkeley, and very much involved in our local traditional ecological knowledge work. Mel, I want to ask you about our area, and your focus has been here, and can you discuss climate resilience in a hot, dry climate like ours? How do you envision our survival here with the rising temperatures?
Absolutely. So, I mean, we already know, right? Wildfires are going to be a big part of our climate future. You know, bigger, hotter wildfires. But what a lot of people don't realize is sort of the flip side of that, which is the big floods. So the way that all of the climate models, as well as traditional knowledge, kind of, you know, the way it seems to be going is that we're going to have shorter, more intense wet seasons. So basically, we're going to get our whole year's worth of rain in just a couple of months, and then the rest of the year is going to be super dry. And so we have a fire problem in the mountains and a flood problem in the valley. And so, you know, if we didn't know any better, right, we would say we'd be trapped, right, in between these two, like, huge hazard areas. But, you know, thankfully, we do have traditional ecological knowledge to learn from. We have knowledge that ALLI has, that the Maidu Summit Consortium has, all of these tribes who have been through these types of localized climate impacts before, right? And this is a big thing about why all of us who are non-native, I'm non-native, but we need to accept and recognize the authority of tribes and tribal people over land use and land management. Because just by virtue of being on this particular piece of land for 20, 40,000 years, right, they've seen it all, right? They know what happens in this place, in this specific place. So, you know, there's a lot of knowledge that around the 200-year flood, this is what ALLI is trying to educate a lot of folks about. California is only 180 years old. So we wouldn't know about the 200-year flood if we've only been here for 180 years. So that's why it's really important to listen to the tribes and what they are preparing for and saying. You know, we need to prepare those places in high ground. And, in order to escape the flood, you have to move up to the fire area. But the good thing about the being up in the fire area is that we can do something about it. We can bring back cultural and prescribed burning. We can manage the forest to make sure, we can offset and, you know, hopefully end the practices of the timber companies that have made our fire landscapes, you know, basically matchbooks on a mountainside. Like, that's not the actual natural state of the forest. And that, you know, that's what where traditional ecological stewardship is so important and so ultra important, is because we need to learn from the people who know this place so intimately and have been here and have seen all of the great disaster cycles that happen in California that have now been corroborated by climate science and climate modeling. So, you know, that's, to me, that is, you know, the incompromisable key to being able to survive in this place, is that we need to follow the leadership of the indigenous people and learn from that knowledge and, you know, kind of humble our own sort of colonizer mentalities a little bit to understand, you know, what it means to live here for several generations, not just like three or four.
Listen and learn. So in the time we have left, can you describe your actual projects here and how people can be involved?
Sure. So right now, so I've actually right as we speak, I had to leave the project now, is the weekly community workday at Verbena Fields. That's off of First Avenue in North Chico. And so we've been working every week, right, from 10 to 1, a number of community volunteers, anyone can come to tend this 17 acres of native restoration and an interpretive site that is maintained by Ali and the Michupta. It's one of these places where we are starting to begin to see what the this landscape here in Chico should look like, right? You know, we're out there planting, we're doing some fuels management, and the riparian area as well. So it was restored as a floodplain to do flood control, but because the channel hadn't been taken care of, it wasn't working properly. So what we've been doing for the past year is to sort of clean up the willows, to harvest the willows and use them for different things like basketry and other types of materials. We wove willow walls to help to guide the water so that this last time, this last big rainstorm, we actually saw the floodplain. I saw for the first time since moving here, this floodplain actually working the way that it should. And so that's, you know, a big thing that we're doing there. We're doing, I'm sure if people pass by Verbena Fields, you've seen the little piles of wood. So we are, we've been basically doing fuels management and basically managing the slash so that we reduce the fire hazard. And so all of that. We also have a professional crew coming out of the Michupta tribe that works. It has been working. They've been working in Concow for the past several months, helping low-income residents who were not kind of left behind by the recovery process so that they can rebuild and get into their homes safely. And just now this weekend, we're also participating in the new Butte County Caltrex program, which is going to bring prescribed burning back to this place. And also TEK kind of enhanced cultural burning. We were so, lucky to have Don Hankins here, who has been, you know, here for decades, actually, you know, educating the community about prescribed fire and cultural fire. And so we're actually taking steps now in conjunction with the Caltrex program to make that happen. So, you know, we're making a lot of moves over the next several years. We're looking into hazard mitigation and doing some climate adaptation demonstration projects. So, and that's going to be sort of, we have to get funding and all of that first, but, you know, all of that's in the cards. So, you know, you'll definitely see us out and about. But come to Verbena Fields if you want to really dig in and see what it's all about.
You know, I have one more question. We have 1 minute.
Sure.
You were at Black Rock, and I was wondering, there was an incredible art installation there that it's been inspiring people all over the world. It was in San Francisco last week. In the last minute, can you tell us about what that was, why you went, and what you did?
Sure. So BlackRock is the number one investor in fossil fuel projects around the world. It's also one of the top asset managers for real estate. And we all know the real estate market is really, really messed up here in Chico. And also, so, you know, BlackRock, like, as an institution, is one of the major drivers of climate change just by funding all of these destructive projects. And so we, you know, we're very honored to go and join a contingent of all kinds of people to paint a mural right in front of BlackRock headquarters to tell them to stop funding climate chaos and stop funding destruction. The paint was made from ashes from paradise. So Alan Myers, head of Regenerating Paradise, he brought ashes made with the ashes of his family home. Wendy McCall, Carrie Max, and me and Allie and Mary Kay Benson, we went over there as one of the few sort of contingents from an actual fire area and some fire survivors to send the message directly to BlackRock about the destruction, about the consequences of the destruction that they've been funding. So I'm glad that that's been resonating around the world. And we need more of that kind of solidarity and that kind of cross-cultural actions to really, you know, do what needs to be done.
That's amazing. It was amazing. And it was also on Imagining Communities last night, which I can post the link to that, the talks that were made. Mel Figueroa, thank you for your work. Do you have a link to your work? Is there something people can read?
Sure. Absolutely. People can visit tekchico.org.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, a couple of announcements before we do the top of the hour stuff. On November 11th, Butte Environmental Council is doing a community CEQA workshop. This is important because there's something called Valley's Edge that will really destabilize the town of Chico with a lot more fossil fuel impacts and emissions. And it will be very, very, very difficult project to have our town ever reach any sort of balance. So anyway, this go to Butte Environmental Council for more about this CEQA workshop about how you can weigh in. On November 16th, Butte Environmental Council is also working with GRUB for a Food Security in a Changing World workshop. And lastly, I wanted to mention that the Campfire Restoration Project is having a TEK work study plant walks at Verbena Fields with Mel Figueroa and Allie Mettersnight on the 30th of November at 4 p.m. But they're also out there every Friday, as Mel said. So go to their tekchico.org website for more information. All right. Now, you're listening to the Peace and Justice Program, and I want to thank our underwriters, as well as all of you listeners who pledged during our recent pledge drive. We depend on you, and we appreciate you so much. So thank you, everyone, who helped out during pledge drives. And also thank you to Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. And by Quicksilver Courier Service. Established in 2010, Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services for private individuals, as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit chicocourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. I'd also like to thank Paradise Community Guilds, fostering community by nurturing creativity, practicing stewardship of nature, and promoting values of sustainability. Paradise Community Guilds invites all people of goodwill and community spirit to help carry out that intent. To get involved, visit paradiseguilds.org, also on Facebook, and at 762-1490. And by ChicoCallCenter.com, employing locally since 1999, Chico Call Center is rapidly expanding and is now hiring new employees for their Nord Avenue location. Chico Call Center works with over 200 newspapers nationwide, renewing customer subscriptions. Compensation packages include hourly commission and nightly cash payouts. More information by visiting ChicoCallCenter.com.
www.kzfm.com. And it is just about the top of the hour. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. The opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. They are just my own and my guests. So I'd like to give you a song from a CD called Take Me Home. It's Peace Songs, and it's Jim Stringer. And then we'll get our next guest on the line. Here you go.
There was a war. The last war, though at the time nobody knew. It was just what they called it, like the Gulf War or World War II. Last in the sense of previous, like the one before the next. Last meaning final, nobody knew. It was not used in the context.
It pitted woman on man and nation on nation. The last war buried an entire generation. No one was spared for the colors that he wore. Not the rich, not the poor. In the last war.
War made few heroes and many a villain. In the years that followed, tempers flared, but nobody seemed willing. No, for once, enough blood had spilled for a megalomaniac's petty coup d'etat. Not one more daughter or brother would die, however low or noble the cause.
All right. Those wars. Okay, we're going to be talking a little bit about war, but mainly we are going to be talking about WikiLeaks and Julian Assange in this next segment. And that is important to you. You may not realize it. Some of you might think, that's a story that's been going on, and I have no idea anymore what it's about, and, you know, don't really care, doesn't have anything to do with me. But unfortunately, press freedom is very much at risk right now, and our guest is going to be talking about that. It does center around the issues of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange's possible prosecution under the Espionage Act. So on the phone with me, I have Marjorie Cohn. She is Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, where she taught from 1991 to 2016. She's a former criminal defense attorney, past president of the National Lawyers Guild. She lectures, writes, and provides commentary for local, regional, and national international media. She's also the co-host of Law and Disorder on WBAI Radio in New York, so salutes to them. She is the co-author of many books. One of the most recent ones I have that I refer to all the time is Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. She has been a staff counsel for the California Agricultural Labor Relations Board. She is the U.S. representative of the Executive Committee of the Association of American Jurists and is Deputy Secretary General of the Bureau of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. She also sits on the board of directors of many groups that I care about, and I really appreciate her work also on the advisory committee of the Assange Defense Committee. So, Marjorie Cohn, welcome to the Peace and Justice Program.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Sure. I didn't want to spend the whole show talking about you because you have such a phenomenal career, and I so much appreciate your being with us today. I wanted to have you first discuss WikiLeaks. People, I do not think, respect what WikiLeaks was and what it did in terms of these wars that we endured over the last 20 years. Can you tell us about the kind of the timeline and then also what WikiLeaks was and what it revealed?
Yes. Well, in 2007, WikiLeaks posted the U.S. Army Manual of Standard Operating Procedures for detainees at Guantanamo Bay. And in 2010 to 2011, and these are the revelations that are the substance of the pending indictment against Julian Assange, 2010 to 2011, WikiLeaks revealed U.S. war crimes in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay. And they included 400,000 field reports about the Iraq War, 15,000 unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians, and evidence of the systematic torture, rape, and murder after U.S. forces handed over detainees to a notorious Iraqi torture squad. They also included the Afghan war logs, 90,000 reports that revealed more civilian casualties by coalition forces than the U.S. military had reported, and they included the Guantanamo files, which were 779 secret reports that revealed that 150 innocent people had been imprisoned there for years and documented the torture and abuse of some 800 men and boys in violation of the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment. Perhaps the most notable release by WikiLeaks was the 2007 collateral murder video, in which a U.S. Army Apache helicopter gunship in Baghdad targets and fires on unarmed civilians. At least 18 civilians were killed, including two Reuters journalists and a man trying to rescue the wounded. Two children were injured, and then a U.S. Army tank drove over one of the bodies, cutting it in half. That video depicts three separate war crimes prohibited by the Geneva Conventions and the U.S. Army Field Manual. And then in 2017, WikiLeaks started posting Vault 7, which the CIA called the largest data loss in CIA history. And it is a collection of thousands of internal CIA documents that detail a covert hacking program carried out by the agency and the malware and software it uses to spy on smart TVs, operating systems of most smartphones and web browsers, the electronic surveillance that the CIA conducts.
So, you know, this is overwhelming to me. I showed the video many times of that helicopter gunship and what it did, and that alone, I am so grateful that that has been revealed to the American people to show us those war crimes. But everything you revealed just then is absolutely chilling. And I'd like you to tell us, please, about Julian Assange. In 2019, the U.S. government charged the WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, with violating the Espionage Act. The scope of the charges have raised concerns about the First Amendment protections for journalists and others who publish classified information. Can you tell our listeners the details of the government's case and your concerns about the implications of the case if Assange is found guilty?
Yes. Well, Barack Obama, who indicted more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act than all of his predecessors combined, considered indicting Julian Assange for revealing evidence of war crimes. There was a secret grand jury impaneled, and they decided not to indict Assange because of what they called the New York Times problem, because WikiLeaks did what the New York Times, the Washington Post, Der Spiegel, Le Monde, etc. did, which was to publish classified documents. So Obama decided not to indict Julian Assange. Well, during the Trump administration, they did file a secret indictment against Assange in 2018. It became public in 2019. And the first indictment charged him with hacking. They're trying to paint him as a hacker so that he doesn't have First Amendment protections that a journalist enjoys. And then a second indictment was filed, and that charged him with 17 counts under the Espionage Act, and he is now facing 175 years in prison. But they realized that the first hacking charge was weak, so they filed another indictment. This is the Trump administration, and charged him with hacking based on revelations and allegations by Sigur Thordarson in Iceland. And later, he admitted that, in fact, they were false charges, that he only did it to get a good plea bargain from the FBI. What happened was that he was charged under the Trump administration, after a three-week extradition hearing in London, the judge in the UK denied the Trump administration's request to extradite Julian Assange to the U.S. for trial on this indictment because she found that he would be at high risk of suicide given the expert testimony and his mental health, and that the U.S. prison system could not properly protect him. Well, as they were leaving office, the Trump administration appealed that denial of extradition. And then in comes Joe Biden. But instead of dropping the indictment and the appeal of extradition the way his predecessor would have, you know, he always links himself to Barack. You know, Barack and I did this and Barack and I did that. But Joe Biden didn't do what Barack did. He is continuing to pursue that appeal, in terms of if he does get extradited to the U.S., tried and convicted, that will send a very strong message and chill the willingness of national security investigative journalists to publish classified information, which journalists do all the time. So it has tremendous ramifications for the First Amendment freedom of the press.
So a lot hinges in the British courts. You still there?
Yeah.
Okay.
I am.
Yeah. In the British courts around Julian Assange's mental health and also his risk of suicide. But I'd like to take you back a little bit because this man has been fighting extradition for one thing or another since 2010. And can you just tell us about why he might be depressed?
Well, yes. In 2012, Julian Assange took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy. They gave him asylum because Sweden was trying to extradite him on trumped-up charges of sexual assault, which were later discredited. The so-called complaining witnesses said that they lied. And there was a fear that he would be, that if he was sent to Sweden, Sweden then would send him to the U.S. So Julian Assange spent 7 years in the Ecuadorian embassy, and during that time he had some pretty serious health issues, but the U.K. refused to guarantee that they wouldn't extradite him or arrest him if he left the Ecuadorian embassy, so he was not allowed to go to the hospital. And Niels Melzer, former U.N. Special Rapporteur on Torture, examined Julian Assange and said that he was suffering from prolonged psychological torture. Then in 2019, a new president came in Ecuador, and a very pro-U.S. president, and in order to facilitate the U.S. Extradition of Julian Assange, the U.K. police dragged him from the Ecuadorian embassy and arrested him on violating bail conditions, which, of course, he had a right to apply for asylum, and the bail condition charge was trumped up as well. But this was UK's effort to help the U.S. facilitate the extradition to the United States. So he has now been in prison, in a maximum security prison in London, the Belmarsh prison, for the last 2 years.
So this man has really, really carried a big burden for his effort to release public documents for the public good. They are targeting the messenger, and he fears, and his supporters fear, that he'll be treated like whistleblower Private Chelsea Manning, who leaked documents to WikiLeaks. And can you tell us about what happened to Chelsea Manning, why you're concerned about U.S. conditions for Assange being somewhat similar?
Yes, Chelsea Manning was subjected to torture and cruel treatment when she was held in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day for 11 months and also made to stand naked for inspection. The U.N. Special Rapporteur said that this was, at a minimum, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, and if he were given more complete access to her, he could have determined whether it amounted to torture. But solitary confinement is well established that it constitutes torture. And there was a lot of testimony at the three-week extradition hearing in September last year that Julian Assange, if he was extradited to the U.S., he would be placed under what are called special administrative measures, or SAMs, onerous conditions that keep him in virtual isolation from all other prisoners. It's what they do with terrorism suspects. And that he would be held in a maximum security prison, ADX, in Florence, Colorado. And he also would be tried in a court in Virginia, which is the most conservative court in the U.S., where the so-called war on terror cases have been prosecuted. It would be impossible for him to get a fair trial, to say nothing of his risk of suicide if he were extradited. And that risk of suicide is what came out at both the extradition hearing in September and the two-day appeals hearing at the in late October in London, where there was a lot of expert testimony about his risk of suicide if he were extradited to the U.S. for trial.
I'm talking to Marjorie Cohen. She is an attorney as well as an author and a social justice advocate for Julian Assange, and in many cases for other peace and justice causes. And Marjorie Cohen is talking to us about Julian Assange and the risks he faces if he is extradited to the United States for his journalistic efforts to bring the truth to the American people during the wars of the last 20 years, at least since 2010. So what are your overall concerns about this case right now? And what are the risks to press freedom in the United States regarding if Julian Assange is put away for the rest of his life under these horrible conditions?
Well, first of all, there is a real fear for his life because
right.
in 2017, then CIA Director Mike Pompeo, during the Trump administration, called WikiLeaks a non-state hostile intelligence service, and the CIA and government officials hatched secret war plans to abduct and kill Assange, according to a stunning Yahoo News report recently. And senior CIA and Trump administration officials requested sketches or options for ways to assassinate him. Trump himself asked whether the CIA could assassinate Assange, and he wanted options for how to do so. Pompeo was advocating extraordinary rendition of Assange. That's what the CIA used in its so-called war on terror to illegally seize suspects and send them to its black sites for torture. And some people in the CIA wanted to assassinate Assange outright by poisoning or shooting him to avoid the hassle of kidnapping him. So there's a danger to his life. There are credible threats of suicide, given his fragile mental condition. And as I said, there was a lot of testimony at the hearing about that. But if he is ultimately extradited and tried, convicted, and sentenced on this indictment in the U.S., this will send a message to journalists that the conduct that they routinely engage in and that they have to engage in order to do the work that the public needs them to do, they could be indicted under the Espionage Act. I mean, journalists in corporate media and alternative media regularly speak with sources, ask for documentation and clarification, receive and publish documents that the government considers secret, and publish classified information in order to inform us about what our government is doing in our name and what this indictment does is to effectively criminalize these very common and critical journalistic practices. So this is not just about Julian Assange. It's about the right to freedom of the press, which is not just the right of journalists to publish what they want and secret documents that the government doesn't want us to see, but also the American people's right to know what our government is doing, what their tax dollars are being used for. And this is really, really an important case for those reasons.
Yes. So what are the latest updates on the case within the British legal system? I know that that the United States is going, we'll send him to Australia to serve out his term. And they're trying to kind of make this softer. But can you tell us what the issues are at this moment and what is next?
Yes. Well, on January 6th, a U.S. District Judge Vanessa Baratzer, a U.K. District Judge Baratzer, denied extradition, as I said, because of the strong likelihood that Assange would commit suicide. Mm-hmm. And she relied largely on the expert testimony of defense expert Professor Michael Koppelman, who said, "I'm as confident as a psychiatrist can ever be that if extradition to the United States were to become imminent, Mr. Assange would find a way of suiciding." Well, Baratzer found that the risk of suicide was substantial, very high, and therefore denied extradition. Well, the Department of Justice, this is the Biden Justice Department now, for the first time on appeal, because they didn't raise this during the three-week extradition hearing last fall, the Department of Justice didn't raise it. They are providing conditional assurances that if Julian Assange is imprisoned in the United States, he would not be sent to this maximum security prison, ADX, in Colorado. He would not be subject to these onerous special administrative measures, and he could serve any sentence that he may receive in Australia. These are called assurances, and they're not really assurances because they're conditional. Because they also have an out. The Department of Justice said, well, if he does anything that would warrant it, then we can impose these special administrative measures and send him to ADX prison. But even if they don't, and there was testimony about this, he would still be placed in pretrial administrative segregation, which is very much like the special administrative measures, and he would be sent to another maximum security prison where he'd be kept in virtual isolation. So these so-called assurances are really a straw man, so to speak, to try to get the appeals court in the UK to reverse the denial of extradition and send him to the United States.
Yeah, I have two more questions. We have 3 minutes. One of them is I read there's a new group called Distributed Denial of Secrets, DDO Secrets, who are leaking information now. So there's no effect, is there, of doing this to Julian Assange, because there will still be people, as there always have been, leaking information to journalists. Is this true?
You know, I am not familiar with the details of what you bring up, that DDO,
yeah.
But I know that WikiLeaks is continuing to function and has tremendous capacity to both secure and publish and distribute this information that our government is trying to keep secret. So whereas there will probably still be whistleblowers and publishers who try to publish this information, a lot of investigative security journalists, national security journalists, will be deterred from doing this because they know that they could become defendants in Extradition Act prosecutions. And the Extradition Act, by the way, was from 1907, was for spies. I think it was 1907,
right.
1917, I can't remember which, but it was to target spies, not publishers that publish information that all other journalists publish routinely. So this is really a misuse of the Espionage Act, but other journalists are going to be chilled from really carrying out journalism as it has been carried out and should continue to be carried out to inform the public if Julian Assange is extradited and tried and convicted.
Marjorie Cohen, my last question is, how can listeners find out more, get involved, or weigh in the case of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange?
Yes, there is an organization called AssangeDefense.org, and the three co-chairs of Assange Defense are Daniel Ellsberg, Alice Walker, and Noam Chomsky. I'm on the National Advisory Board, and there are chapters all over the country. I'm involved with the Southern California chapter, but we put on programs, we cover these hearings, put out all kinds of information, and also, if you go to AssangeDefense.org, you can find out how to get involved in supporting this really important case to liberate Julian Assange.
I want to thank you so much for being with us today, for giving our listeners this information, and I hope people will get involved and do everything we can in order to fight the extradition. And I think you're calling for him to go be freed and to be recognized as a hero, right?
Yes, exactly. He should be commended for his courage, not incarcerated for one more minute. He's been in confinement for 9 years. He's in fragile mental health. It took tremendous courage to do what he did, and WikiLeaks did, and he should be commended, not jailed.
Well, I thank you. I thank you for all of your work. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
All right. Bye-bye. All right. So the Peace and Justice program here on your community radio station, which is the best of Chico radio stations. So please help spread the word about our work here, our music here, everything you love about KZFR, and let's keep it going. I am going to get my next guest on the line a little bit early here, I think, if I can. There is so much to talk about with every one of these guests. They're so amazing. So anyway, once again, I'm gushing. Sorry, I shouldn't do that, but let's see. This is a song that I thought was wonderful, and it's just fun, and it's a little rousing, so here we go, change of pace, let's see if I can get the cursor on there. All right, enjoy, this is the Bushwhackers.
Well, you can't eat coal, and you can't breathe gas, they're selling out the country for a pile of cash, they're digging it up and shipping it out. Wherever it can be found, they'll send it off to China, leave it in the ground. They'll send it off to China, leave it in the ground. Well, I'm lying awake and listening to the coal trains in the night. Well, I meet the multinational bottom line. By the time it's on the water, we've already lost the fight, and our children are the victims of the crime. There's miles and miles of farming land. The rural family lose their land. They're driving them to debt and fear and pain and suicide. The truth is that their blood is on your hands. 'Cause you can't eat coal and you can't breathe gas. They're selling out the country for a pile of cash. They're digging it up and shipping it out wherever it can be found. They'll send it off to China, leave it in the ground. They'll send it off to China, leave it in the ground. Well, they're fracking here, they're fracking there, just like they own the joint, 'cause the government has given them the right. Election funding guaranteed, well, that's a bloody point. I don't know how you bastards sleep at night. 'Cause you can't eat coal and you can't breathe gas. They're selling out the country for a pile of cash. They're digging it up and shipping it out wherever it can be found. They'll send it off to China, leave it in the ground. They'll send it off to China, leave it in the ground. Moonscape, the scenery is shot, your coal dust poison floating on the breeze.
The aquifers are dying, they're ruining the crop. We've got to put an end to this disease. 'Cause you can't eat coal and you can't breathe gas. They're selling out the country for a pile of cash. They're digging it up and shipping it out wherever it can be found. Now send it off to China, leave it in the ground. No, you can't eat coal and you can't breathe gas. They're selling out the country for a pile of cash. They're digging it up and shipping it out wherever it can be found. Now send it off to China, leave it in the ground. No, you can't eat coal and you can't breathe gas. They're selling out the country for a pile of cash. They're digging it up and shipping it out wherever it can be found. Now send it off to China, leave it in the ground. Now send it off to China, leave it in the ground.
Kids are running through the knee-high corn. Sunburned nose and a scabbed up knee from a rope at the white oak tree. Just another summer's day at Grandpa's farm with Grandma's bucket hanging off my arm. You know the old pump's rusty, but it works fine, primed with water from another time. You don't take much, but you gotta have some. Old ways help, the new ways come. Just leave a little extra for the next in line. They're gonna need a little water from another time. Tattered quilt on the goose down bed. Every stitch tells a story, my grandma said. Her mama's nightgown, grandpa's pants, and the dress she wore to her high school dance. Now wrapped at night in those patchwork scenes, I waltz with Grandma in my dreams. My arms, my heart, my life entwined.
All right, that's Water from Another Time, John McCutcheon. I have on the line with me David Swanson. He's the author, activist, journalist, and radio host. He's a co-founder and executive director of worldbeyondwar.org and campaign coordinator for rootsaction.org. Swanson's books include War is a Lie, and he blogs at davidswanson.org, and warisacrime.org. He's very prolific. He hosts Talk Nation Radio. He's a Nobel Peace Prize nominee and was awarded the 2018 Peace Prize by the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation. His organization, World Beyond War, won the 2021 Peace Prize by the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation also yesterday, and that was very exciting. Welcome, David Swanson, to the Peace and Justice Show.
Thank you. You're very up to date.
Yeah, I was at your webinar yesterday about Armistice Day, the past and future of Armistice Remembrance Day, a global webinar, and it was wonderful. There, I learned so much about what people are doing around the world, and I went to your website and saw all the work that you're doing on World Beyond War. So can you just first tell us a little bit about World Beyond War, because we're going to be talking about climate change here in a minute and militarism. So toot your horn first.
Well, World Beyond War is a global organization that does education work and nonviolent activism work towards the goal of eliminating war, ending all wars, scaling back militarism, getting rid of weapons deals and militaries. And so we do webinars, and we do online courses, and we do real world courses, and we do books and videos and all sorts of educational materials. And we do campaigns around decreasing military spending, divesting institutions and individuals and governments from weapons companies, around blocking, preventing and closing military bases, et cetera, et cetera. And we've, you know, formed dozens of chapters in various countries and have people who have taken part in one way or another in 192 countries and growing.
Yeah, it is an amazing It is an amazing body of work that you're involved in, and so that's why I especially thank you for being with us today. And I just wanted to tell you and our listeners, of course, that we know this, but November 8th was the anniversary, the third anniversary of the campfire that destroyed our neighbors and Paradise and many of the communities around Paradise. And so this is a time of year that we ordinarily think about the horrors of climate change, and also now there are youth in the street as we speak in Glasgow today, and young people are just enraged about the situation of their planet and the absolute disregard of the corporate states. And in your case, in my case, we have been looking at a long time about U.S. militarism and the fact that so much money goes into it, as well as the environmental damage it causes. So I would like you to make the case for our listeners about militarism and its effect on the climate.
Yeah, well, this is one of the demands that at least a big section of the crowd in Glasgow and around the world is demanding that these climate agreements stop excluding militaries, stop giving a total waiver to the world's militaries, despite militaries being a major contributor to destroying the climate. You know, it's as if we had two planets, you know, one on which we'll clean up the civilian industries and the other on which we'll, you know, reform them and green the militaries. And, you know, we can do them separately, but we only have one planet, and it's absolute absurdity to act as if, you know, we can just exclude a major sector of greenhouse gas emissions, climate destruction, that is also a major poisoner of water, air, soil, and ecosystems in countless other ways, and is, you know, the most obvious place where the funding is being wasted that could be going into trying to slow down the destruction of the environment. And so we have a petition at COP26.info. It is not too late to go and sign it. Tens of thousands of people and hundreds of organizations have signed it at COP26.info that says to the COP26 meeting, and we have people delivering it there in person in Scotland, stop excluding militaries. This has been done in all the previous meetings, going back to, you know, a decision being made in Kyoto, and it makes absolutely no sense. You have governments claiming that they're putting together laws or at least rules or at least voluntary guidance, suggestion, talking points on how to stop destroying the climate. And they're leaving out, you know, in the case of just the U.S. military alone, a producer of greenhouse gases worse than most governments on Earth, the most nations on Earth in their entirety. If you took a list of all the nations ranked by greenhouse gas emissions, and you pretended that the U.S. military was a nation, it would be higher. It would be worse than three quarters of the entire nations. And so to just leave it out because your governments are bought and owned by the weapons dealers, and you've managed to convince certain viewers of corporate media outlets that it's more important to be able to kill lots of people in the short term than to prevent the elimination of life in the slightly longer term, it just seems crazy to me.
Well, it is crazy. So, you know, you have done so much. And one of the things I want to let our listeners know is that you appealed with Veterans for Peace, I believe, to John Kerry, who is the special presidential envoy for climate, before this even started, a sign-on letter with many people. Can you talk about the framing of the COP and whether you got any response from John Kerry?
Yeah, well, I'm proud to say I'm on the advisory board of Veterans for Peace, and I take great pride and encouragement in all the great work that organization does, but I didn't have much, if anything, to do with getting to John Kerry's office. We do work together on this issue, World Beyond War and Veterans for Peace and many other organizations, but this was Veterans for Peace that got a meeting with John Kerry's office and apparently got, you know, little, if any, encouraging response. You know, John Kerry has not been a peace activist for decades and has been pretty much the opposite of that for decades. And it's not as if he or any member of the U.S. government doesn't know that the U.S. military is a major polluter. It's not as if the U.S. military doesn't know that, or we have to inform them. They put out reports about it themselves all the time, not reporting in detail on the extent of the destruction they're doing, but on, you know, their claims to be very, very slightly greening their operations, their advocacy for adapting to the destruction rather than ceasing to exacerbate it, and their preference for, you know, blaming the victims and treating climate collapse as an opportunity to further militarize the world and its borders and to go after refugee crises and to go after territory and further access to fossil fuels where the ice is melting. I mean, this is, and people are just, people who've heard, you know, politicians denying that the climate collapse even exists are just, you know, swooning in awe and admiration that the U.S. military admits it exists, as if that's good enough. And of course, it isn't good enough. Congresswoman Barbara Lee has a new resolution in Congress this week that would add, if it were passed by both houses and passed the White House and so forth, would, you know, ask the U.S. military to do better. But the military can't do better in a significant way, you know, and Tesla building tanks and trying to get the military to buy its electric tanks, you know, which would then be fueled by electricity from coal. You know, this is not a solution. Most of the climate destruction by the U.S. military is by airplanes, is by jet fuel. And there's, you know, even if there were a credible prospect of having some alternative fuel that was really going to work in the near future, we don't have the time or the resources. We can't be rebuilding the biggest military, the most expensive military ever seen on the planet with Tesla tanks. We have to be putting our resources into where they're actually needed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I just want to let our listeners know, since we are in California, that Barbara Lee, this resolution is in support of the legal mandate within the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2021 that says not later than 180 days after the date of the enactment of this act, the Secretary of Defense shall submit to the committees of armed forces of the Senate and House of Representatives and to the Comptroller General a report on the total level of greenhouse gas emissions for each of the last 10 fiscal years. I mean, doing a report is not the same as changing anything. So I really appreciate what you're saying, and I'm wondering, as usual, about what we're going to do about it. But at the same time, I want to support you with this petition campaign. And there's over 300 organizations and 20,000 people have signed the petition that you mentioned earlier. Can you talk about that again, about who in the is involved, because this is a huge movement?
Yeah, in fact, over 500 organizations and 25,000 people at this point and growing. And again, that petition, thank you, is at COP26.info. And it's asking for a global international treaty, a written law for tougher standards on greenhouse gas emission reductions, and that militaries be included in there. And of course, getting credible reports out of the militaries on what they are emitting into the atmosphere and how much they're reducing it is part of that, is a necessary part of that. But passing a resolution just telling the U.S. military to comply with an existing law that it's, you know, refusing to comply with or can be expected to continue refusing to comply with, you know, that just, you know, even if that were honored, that would just get you a report, credible or otherwise. it wouldn't get you what's actually needed, which again goes beyond militaries reducing their environmental destruction to actually reducing militaries, which is the only way you're going to do it sufficiently quickly and at a large enough scale to have an impact, which is, of course, why they've left militaries out of the climate agreements for all these years, is because if they included militaries, they would have to radically scale back militarism or something else or some combination in order to meet the goal.
So there are events in Glasgow right now, and you had one yesterday, I know, where speakers were from the United States, from Code Pink, and a lot of Veterans for Peace was there. World Beyond War was there. When they got up before this huge crowd, what was the response?
Yeah, well, there was a rally. I don't know if it was huge, but there was a rally that we organized together with a bunch of peace and environmental groups from around the world, including those that you named, in downtown Glasgow on Thursday, and is specifically about the petition, about the demand we've been discussing. There was some media coverage, and there was some social media coverage that I've seen, but not nearly what's needed. There have been endless rallies and marches and impromptu disruptions of events and banner drops and parades, you know, going on for days and for weeks to come, I think, in Glasgow. Today, Friday, is, of course, the weekly, you know, Youth Action Day, climate strike, leave school and protest for the climate that's been going on for a long time now and is happening today in Glasgow. And so there are marches with banners and things I'm getting sent photos and videos of. But Saturday, November 6th, is the really big day with the really big rally and the really big march all the way through the middle of Glasgow and out the other side, and the day when there are the most events planned in solidarity all around the world. And you can find some of those if you go to COP26.info.
Okay, so we have a lot of time left, and I want to be conscious about the fact that you've laid out the case about what the problem is. But and I know that Beyond War spends so much time and energy trying to educate people. What do you feel that those of us who are in rural towns like in Chico, California, what should we be doing?
Well, there's, you know, endless things that people can be doing, including signing that petition, sharing that petition, recruiting other individuals and organizations to sign on and promote that petition, getting local organizations on board with the agenda, forming a coalition of local peace groups and environmental groups, you know, the big environmental groups that people have mostly heard of, mostly won't go within 10 miles of peace, but all their local chapters will immediately, no hesitation. And if there aren't peace and environmental groups in your town, create them, create a chapter of World Beyond War, create a chapter of Sierra Club and every other environmental group, or better, Extinction Rebellion or Greenpeace or one of the groups that actually is on board at the top level as well. And then use that local coalition to pass, if you haven't already, through big institutions and through your local government, divestment from both fossil fuels and weapons companies, and educate people about the interlocking nature of those two supposedly separate issues through the process of winning that divestment policy. Work on, holding real world events and online events and get World Beyond War to help. Work on getting speakers and events into schools and clubs and other institutions in your area. We have to work nationally, but nobody ever needs to be told that, and very few people ever, get very far at it. We also should be working locally and globally, become part of global organizations and coalitions like the one at COP26.info and see what we can get done where there are governments that are slightly more responsive than the U.S. government. Although I believe there remains in the Build Back Better legislation some vestige of jobs, green jobs, and so forth, and apparently they are pretending they're going to pass it today, but now they're not. So if there is a day to call Congress and demand that they pass something, maybe it's today.
Yeah, shocking. Shocking what has been able to happen with just one person like Joe Manchin. But we're talking to David Swanson. He's the executive director of World Beyond War. And I wanted to let people know that here locally, the most hopeful thing I have seen that brings everything together is Democratic Socialists of America Chico chapter is having a webinar on the 7th at 6 p.m. It's called Overgrow Imperialism, End War, End the Climate Crisis. And this is an Armistice Day event. So they are obviously getting it, bringing it together. And they're some of our local advocates for the unhoused and who do a lot of work in our community. So, David Swanson, I think those were really good suggestions. I'm very excited about what you said. And I was wondering, what has been the response of young people? When I've been on the two webinars recently, it's all been people of the Vietnam generation. And I was wondering, are you seeing a lot of interest in this in the youth? You said earlier that there was, that people were picking it up, but they're not, I haven't seen them.
Well, I mean, this is a conversation that I've had every day for decades. The peace movement is too old, it's too white, it's too middle class. It's been true every day that we've discussed it for decades, and we've failed to change it every day for decades. It's not, it's not absolute. There are young people in the peace movement, and where the peace movement and environmental movement overlap, there are young people in that, and where the peace movement includes the movement against Israeli wars in particular, you have more young people engaged, even in the United States, in opposing Israeli wars, even though most of the weapons come from the United States, than opposing U.S. wars. So there are places where there is increased activism, but the environmental movement, the climate movement, has managed to reach young people, has managed to get into schools, even into the stories that we read to 3-year-old children. It just saturated our culture in a good way, unlike how Hollywood saturates our culture with some horrible ideas, and that's a tremendous thing. The peace movement has not, there are two, in fact, apocalyptic crises, the likelihood of which has grown pretty much parallel rising graphs. If you look at both of them, one, of course, is climate and ecosystem collapse. The other is nuclear war. Both of them have become significantly more likely. And we only talk about one of them. And thank goodness we talk about one of them. I'm 1,000% in favor of talking about it. But we don't talk about the fact that militarism is a big contributor to the danger of ecosystem collapse, and we never mention the other danger of nuclear apocalypse, because without militarism it wouldn't exist at all. This is what we have to overcome. We have a communication system, a cultural system project to work on beyond just a legislative problem of overcoming a corrupt government.
Yeah, I agree. Everything you have said has just really resonated with me. And once again, I'd like you to direct, we're speaking with David Swanson, and his website, World Beyond War, is just so jam full of information. If you're a teacher, if you want to self-educate yourself, you want to find this place. So tell us again about your work, David Swanson, and how people can find out more.
Thank you. Yeah, well, the petition we've been talking about, the easiest way to get to it is cop26.info. But the organization that I work for that's done the most on this is World Beyond War, and it's at worldbeyondwar.org. And you can go there and find all kinds of resources and information and entertainment and how to get engaged and get involved and how to find or create a local chapter, et cetera.
Well, thank you so much for being my guest today on the Peace and Justice program, and I'm going to be following you guys as closely as I can because it's a wonderful way to get involved and stay involved. Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye. All right. So stay tuned for Playing Dead. Ray Lager is in the house. He'll be with you in a moment. I want to thank our underwriters, and so that would be... Chico Performances, and they're presenting a very Chico Nutcracker on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, December 3rd, 4th, and 5th at Laxon Auditorium. Backed by popular demand, Chico Community Ballet's newly envisioned A Very Chico Nutcracker returns to the stage, infusing the rich history of Chico into the traditional Nutcracker ballet. Tickets at the University Box Office, 898-6333, or at chicoperformances.com, and by Square Deal Mattress Factory, building the best night's sleep since 1920. Square Deal is celebrating over 100 years of making mattresses, bedding, furniture, and now face masks with the fabric of your choice right here in Chico. Square Deal is located at 1354 Humboldt Avenue, and for details, see squaredealmattress.com. And because Armistice Day is coming up this week and I don't do a show till next Friday, I did want to go out before the community calendar with one more thing that I thought was particularly important, and this is Leonard Cohen. Take care, everybody.
In Flanders fields, the poppies blow, between the crosses row on row that mark our place. And in the sky, the larks, still bravely singing, fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago, we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields.
Hey, listeners, it's time for the KZFR.